It's ugh. Like scallion pancake with
but then she's got this cheese
cheese frikke. Yeah. Oh.
The cheese and is 100% made in New York.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then shaved braised shank. Yeah.
That's sick. And a little bit of spice, nice pickled. Nice bit of little Russian dressing kind of
thing. Yeah.
Kind of thing. Yeah. Russian Chinese.
Everything that's sinful in one bite.
I'm Hugh Atchison, and this is Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot. On today's show, I sit down with the New York Magazine food critic Adam Platt, Platty Pants, as he's so well known, at a little shotgun space in Midtown Manhattan called Little Tong Noodle Shop. If you've been listening to this podcast, you've probably heard me talk about Little Tong Noodle Shop. That's because of Adam Platt. He knows New York's best restaurants, and that's where he wanted to meet. If you're enjoying Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot, please rate it. Write a review on your podcast app. If this is your first time listening, please subscribe and check out other episodes like Tom Colicchio Heats Up Leftovers and Michael Stipe Likes a Good Schnitzel. All right, so here's this week's conversation. Adam Platt eats an amazing sandwich. I'm in Midtown Manhattan and sitting at a Little Tong Noodle Shop, and I've got a very curmudgeonly gentleman in front of me whose name is Adam Platt. Adam is the wonderful dining critic for New York Magazine and has been for more than 18 years. And he's not showing it. He still looks 20.
That's a long time now.
It is a long time.
That's one could argue it's a little too long.
Well, yeah, that's a. I mean, a lot of the people you give one stars to will definitely.
I don't do that anymore.
No, I know. There are no stars. I am going to read a starred review of something totally non-food just to get a grasp of criticism and the overwhelming amount of criticism that we have in the world today. Because I find it really interesting. I think it really earmarks our daily routines. Mm-hmm. This is a one-star review of. Lombard Street, the architectural street in San Francisco that's very hilly. I've been on a lot of roads, but this one just doesn't compare to most. First, it's too curvy. I couldn't believe how challenging it was to crank the wheel to the right and then immediately to the left. Even with the aid of modern technology like power steering, I found it a chore to steer. Heck, the curves can't even turn one direction like NASCAR. Second, it's too steep. I had to ride the brakes all the way down. Last, there are way too many people. They act like this is some sort of tourist attraction or something. Avoid this road.
I think I see where you're coming from.
It's the world of criticism.
It's just too much.
It is.
Everybody's a critic. Everybody's criticizing everything all the time.
And do you think that that takes away from your professional astute position as a dining critic?
Well, I would hope not.
Well, you hope not, but I think it already...
But this is the thing. And like when I started doing this job, it was almost 20 years ago. It was, in fact, you've done your research, so it was 18 years ago. And I came to it as really an accidental restaurant critic. Like a lot of food writers and critics from my era, I think it's changed a little bit now, but from my era, we were magazine writers first who liked food. I mean, ideally, I would be a great chef like you, who was also a professional writer. I mean, I think that's the ideal model. But in my day, if you liked food and you could write a little bit, then, give it a shot.
Did it start as a part-time gig?
No, they offered me a full-time job. It was a full-time job, New York Magazine, health benefits. And I actually find food to be a fascinating topic. I'd written about it before. As you know, and as everybody knows now, because the whole genre has exploded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, as with everything with the internet, it's like you have this... especially with the food world, which used to be sort of small and self-regarding and slightly preening, like here we are, this is, and also sort of a little eccentric and off in the corner, right? You had these mandarins who passed judgment, quote unquote, and created these ridiculous star systems, and their generally uninformed public read in this sort of rapt way about where they should go and eat their next meal. That had been cooked up by chefs from overseas, right? So that was sort of the style when I actually started. And shortly after I started, it was really like somebody rolled a hand grenade into this cage of flamingos. The whole thing blew. everything blew up. And it's been expanding ever since, right? I mean,
right.
With the food culture, with the internet.
When you start 18 years ago, I mean, that's the, I mean, Google wasn't around 18 years
ago. Google wasn't around the internet in New York. I'm in New York. And so in many ways, the intensity and the variety that everybody associates with the food world now, because everybody's hooked in, everybody's seen Tony Bourdain, but in many ways that New Yorkers have been that way for a while. So you had this intense culture, and you also had they were called blogs back then, but you had these intense food the people who would go out in the outer boroughs and tell you about the great slice of pizza, or Jim Leff. There are a whole bunch of them.
Chowhound,
and Ed Levine.
Yeah, Ed Levine
who founded Series E. So they were all out doing their thing, and the internet gave voice to them. And so, so if you're a critic, you are actually, I mean, you're trying to establish a point of view, and you're trying to establish a kind of. You want people to pay attention to you, and you're also trying to tell them how to spend their money. So you are trying to cultivate a certain style that is supposed to classically be above the babble of the street, right?
Right.
And so I'm trying to do that. That street's a lot louder, and there's many more people on it, and there's many more people babbling. And meanwhile, of course, the whole model for print journalism has dissolved like a cube of sugar in a rainstorm, right? So it's much harder now. My argument is that you need old-fashioned critics like me. First of all, my argument is that restaurant criticism, and you know this as a great chef. This is a great eater. That everybody has their own opinions. There's nothing more subjective
than food.
Okay. Ergo, there's nothing more subjective than being a food critic, right? If you're a book critic or you're a TV critic, I mean, again, you have your own opinions, or you're coming from a certain set of facts. You have your own tastes, but you're all seeing the same movie. You're all reading the same book. As you know, when it comes to restaurants, everything changes. Your experience changes, not just of the food, but of where you are, but where you're sitting, what time of day is
restaurants,
what kind of food you're eating.
Yeah, restaurants are live action affected by more things than anything.
It's just a chaotic theater all the time.
Yeah.
And so critic's job is sort of make sense of this, right? And also to recreate it. Like, because I'm from a generation who, I think Ruth Reichel is the same way. There are a lot of critics. John the Gold, bless his soul. You are trying to review a restaurant and tell people where to go and how to spend the money, but most of them won't go there. So you're really trying to recreate the experience for what used to be a print audience, right? People who would sit down and actually look forward to this vicarious journey to this far-off noodle shop, or if in New York you could pick any number of places. Not everybody's going to La Bernardina. Not everybody's going to these. So you're really trying to recreate that world for them, and you're doing it from your perspective, and that's pretty much how I've always operated.
Do you think not that you use the star system, but if we equate the star system, has that changed remarkably in how people view it, or are as four stars of the time still only relegated to super fine dining?
Well, you're a chef. What do you think of the star system?
I mean, I think it requires, it's very much like the Michelin system. It requires a lot of attention to bathrooms that I don't really want to do.
Yeah. The star system, like, I don't know many working critics who enjoy the star system.
No,
it's nothing but trouble.
Yeah.
Right. Again, we're talking about. I don't think Gold ever adopted it.
No,
he did not. To his credit, he said, I'm sure they asked him many times. The star system exists for the consumer, and I think to a certain extent more for the restaurateur, much more for the restaurateur than for the critic, because restaurateurs sell it. They like to have it. They want to know. Michelin started as a. They want to be able to buy their tires and to drive around
to go to the country. Wear it on the tires and buy the tires again.
The star system is something that people enjoy, right? And again, it's very subjective. And, I was asked when I started doing this job, we had no star system, because the argument was if you have a star system, people are, A, they're just random. They're also sort of a trap. right? Because this is very true of Michelin. Although I respect Michelin, although it's an impossible job, what happens with Michelin is that the stars become equated with a certain type of restaurant.
Right. Like,
so if you're a three-star restaurant, you're going to be a ridiculously fancy, and with Michelin, it's a certain kind of classic French, sort of now Japanese, but it's a certain kind of gourmet experience, which puts you in a box. So it's a type of restaurant, not an experience. And in this era where you have these noodle shops, these high-end noodle shops, the David Changs of the world popping up all over the place, who's to say what's better, right? A wonderful casual barbecue down in Georgia or a fancy. What's your four-star experience?
So, yeah, but even without stars in the methodology that you're using, are you walking into a Le Bernardin with a different expectation than you're walking into Hunan Slur?
Well, I think yes and no, right? I think Le Bernardin, the thing about Le Bernardin, we all know what Le Bernardin is, right? It's a famous seafood restaurant, Eric Pear. I think if you're paying a certain amount of money, you're walking in, you're expecting a certain kind of experience.
Right.
I don't necessarily think that stars equate to that, actually. I would actually argue, I mean, what's the greatest great barbecue in Athens? What's your favorite? All right, just tell me.
He's crackling just, Atlanta, Georgia.
But you know what I'm saying. So which is the four-star restaurant?
Bee's Crackling is a good example of a very high, or not high end, but really quality driven barbecue restaurant.
All right.
Whole hog.
I'll do this.
Okay.
I'll do a New York example. So in New York, you have Le Bernardin, which happens to be my favorite old fashioned gourmet restaurant. It's not even old fashioned. They're changing all the time. It's a wonderful experience.
It's beautiful.
It's just impeccable theater of a certain kind. And when that restaurant closes, when Maggie Lacoz is the proprietor, or Eric, when they pack up their there ain't gonna be another one.
Yeah.
Right? It is a product of a certain time and a certain sensibility, which is, it sort of encompasses the last 40 years, I'd say. And when it goes, for all sorts of reasons, it ain't coming back.
Right.
Right? Certainly in New York, where the rents are so high. And then you have, let's talk about another temple of old New York dining, Katz's Deli.
Okay.
Right? You've probably been to Katz's a million times.
Yep.
Katz's is down on, Delancey Street, down the Lower East Side.
Yep.
Been in the same building for 500 years. It's got that funk of the deli. I think it's old. But anyway, it's actually gotten better.
Yeah.
Because the people who run it now, it's been in the same family for a long time, but all of these various crafts like pickling and curing your beef and curing your deckel and even hot dogs and even sauerkraut have turned into this with the arrival of the obsessive gourmet, obsessive internet culture, have turned into these crafts that people pay a lot of attention to. And also, Cassis has this gestalt, this sort of much like Bernadette, it's got this certain gestalt of the city that a great restaurant exudes, right? And it's really like a living temple, I think.
Right.
So I would be hard pressed to tell you which one I would give 4 stars or 5 stars. Now I know what the New York Times would say. I know what my magazine would say. But I personally, especially for the money,
they're on the same.
I think they're on the same plane.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm not gonna.
But that is, I think that's the key to the modern era of judging a restaurant in so many ways, is that they should be judged now on authenticity and zeal and that gestalt characteristic.
Right. And also, like I would, in defense of being a restaurant critic, not everybody these days. It's not, but in defense. I mean, again, it's all. I will never. When somebody comes and argues with me, as they often do, like I went to that place. It was crap. And I go, well, it's my opinion, and B, it changes. Yeah. Things changes, and B, and C, people have different tastes.
Yep.
And as well I do. The reviews come out. They take off. The chefs take off. They take a break. It all changes. So I go, Godspeed. Thank you. This is one man's opinion. Obviously, behind that opinion is 1,000 other meals that I've had to consume, which probably the person who was talking to me hasn't. And also behind the old-fashioned critic's argument and sense of judgment is hopefully an expense account where you have an organization which will pay for you to return to these places again and again, not just one time. I mean, I go 2 or 3 times. But that, and that's what's rare in this era of people driving down Lombard Street and sort of telling you out of the, you know, back of their, you know, whatever, you know what I'm talking about? Oh, here, this, this. That is, I think, still the key. And if you have somebody like that who, and it's their job to go to these places, and they just...
Well, I think that because it's the job of a professional critic to walk into a restaurant without the baggage that a typical consumer walks in with sometimes. You walk into one of my restaurants and you've been in a bad mood and something happened at work and you're dining with your toddler and their grandmother and you're having a spat with your wife. Things are... But we have very little chance of making you very happy. But those things wouldn't be hurdles for you as a professional critic because you've learned to stick those aside.
Yes, you have.
And you're probably...
We're professional critics.
You're consistently grumpy, so there,
I'm consistently
that's a plane,
grumpy.
Plane
I'm
that
consistently
you're
grumpy,
from.
Although I'm looking back, like I've been writing a book about, or trying to write a book about my... About weird world that I inhabit, and I do find I'm looking back at my old reviews. I was much meaner when I was started out. I don't know why. I think maybe because I wrote more reviews. I don't know, but like I was, and I do cringe a little. Actually,
I think I cringe at the chef I was 20 years
well,
ago. So you're the,
well,
the,
I think I was. I wasn't a bad. Book. I don't think I was a bad critic.
No,
good,
I wasn't
good.
A bad chef.
But it was
just
angry. I just, yeah, I'm not. It's hard for no restaurateur would believe this because, but I have more sympathy and I don't actually know a lot of critics who enjoy writing
scathing
reviews. But I find that I do it less and less.
ButcherBox.com delivers healthy, 100% grass-fed and finished beef, free-range organic chicken, heritage breed pork, and wild-caught sockeye salmon directly to your door on a monthly basis. All their products are humanely raised and never, ever given those antibiotics or hormones. It's hard to find high-quality meat you can trust at every place in the United States, but ButcherBox is changing that, and they offer free shipping anywhere in the 48 states. Not only is it convenient, the taste is unbelievably good. There's a huge difference in flavor between animals raised on pasture and those fed grain and concentrated animal feedlot operations. There's no commitment, and you can cancel easily at any time. So enjoy. Right now, new subscribers will receive the Ultimate Breakfast Bundle for free in their first box. That's 2 packages of bacon and 2 pounds of breakfast sausage for free, plus $20 off their first box. So there's no excuse. Go to butcherbox.com/Hugh. That's my name. It's H-U-G-H. Enjoy butcherbox.com. Have you ever thought about wanting to talk to someone, but you're unsure of where to start? Trust me, I have. And by talking to someone, I mean like a counselor. Or a therapist, somebody trained in helping you get through the rigmarole of every day in this world. BetterHelp makes it easy to connect with those people, licensed professional counselors and caring professionals who specialize in the issues that you want and need to talk about. Join BetterHelp and get help on your own time and at your own pace. You can schedule secure video and phone sessions. You can text a therapist worldwide. And you can start communicating with that person in under 24 hours of setting it up. It's a truly affordable option, and Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot listeners will get 10% off their first month with discount code Hugh, H-U-G-H. If you've been wanting to talk to someone, you can get started right now. Go to betterhelp.com/Hugh, H-U-G-H, simply fill out the questionnaire and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/Hugh. 4,000 plus U.S. licensed therapists across all 50 states, available worldwide. 4 communication modes, text, chat, phone, and video. Start communicating in under 24 hours. Available on desktop, mobile web, Android, and iOS apps. It's easy to change our counselors if needed. Broad expertise in the network, which may not be locally available in many areas. 2 pricing plans available, all included plan or the messaging only plan. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, secure, convenient, professional, affordable. Get 10% off for your first month. Discount goes Hugh, H-U-G-H.
How long are you waiting these days before you drop a review? I know it's always competitive to get the reviews out there. They all seem to dump at the same time.
Yeah, with my magazine, the magazine that I write for is New York Magazine. Also, the website is called Grub Street. And the reviews are still pegged to the print magazine. My reviews are still pegged to the print magazine. And so the print magazine does not publish weekly now. They publish every other week, sometimes once every 3 weeks. And so I'm writing less and less. I write a lot of online stuff, listicles and the occasional rant. And we have something called First Taste, where you go and you just give your first impression. But my actual reviews, maybe 20 a year. It used to be 35, 40.
Wow.
So they're a lot less. So I'm not in a position to compete with, the Pete Wells is the Times, or Ryan Sutton is the other big critic in town, Eater, who I think write more. I've sort of had to cede that. I'm not trying that much to be timely, which is why I'm hard selling this idea of it's every man's opinion. It is my judicious opinion. And I also think that rush, you also find out other critics, like you find the Times spends a lot, there are many places that I review they haven't reviewed. I think in the olden days, in the old print days, you did have that competition.
Right.
And old style critics have that competition, and they want to be first, they want to scoop. I think you want to be current, but I think in the current, if you want to get people's impressions of the opening restaurant, I mean, you have that after 25 seconds after they open.
Yeah.
People are coming down here and telling you.
Or even before, because of pre-opening parties.
It's just chaos.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
In many ways, waiting a little bit, it might be better. But, I do think the critics' power to open and close restaurants, the Times will always have that power in New York, but I think in general, it may be the Athens Democrat or whatever.
Banner Herald. We don't even
whatever,
have a critic.
Whatever. I think
we had John Kessler for years.
Okay, I'm sure you gnash your teeth about him. But I think that old era of the lordly critic. The movie Ratatouille.
Yeah.
Michael Bauer. Nothing against Michael Bauer, but yeah. Anton Ego, the French, the guy in that great, actually one of the great food movies of all time. I think that era has ended, okay? And if it hasn't been pronounced before, I'm pronouncing it now. But that era, I think is over, except in certain conditions in certain cities. But generally...
I think that still exists, but in New York, somewhat, and London definitely. Jay Rayner, people like that,
London,
still holding court.
They can, if you decide to be mean about a certain, I don't think I have that power, but if you decide to go after a restaurant that is in the wheelhouse of the readership of your publication. It's devastating.
Yeah.
You talk about Jay Rayner and London critics in New York. London critics are their own deal.
Their own Shakespearean.
It's more like
Shakespearean beast.
It's theatrical.
It is really theatrical.
It's really
so
theater.
Over the top. Yeah.
And they often, and again, it's highly, highly amusing, entertaining
it's
theater.
It's abusive theater.
But it's a kind of, I don't think we do that here. Oh boy, here we go.
We're not hungry at all, are we?
I'm going to eat at like 6:30, but I'm going to take a picture of this.
You can take a bite.
Oh no, I might take a bite, but definitely
got to
take a picture.
All right, so this will keep you warm.
Simone is presenting food to us.
This is Simone Tong, who's the wonderful proprietor of this wonderful little noodle shop.
Hi everyone, how are you?
And she has created, like all proprietors of wonderful noodle shops in New York, she's created this nutty sandwich thing here.
Yes, it's
tell us about it.
It's we call it a JB melt, jia bing. Jia bing is like a Chinese word for sandwich. It's a crispy bread with beef shank.
Street food, right?
Yes, cucumbers.
Yep.
Spicy fermented chili mayo,
yep.
And a melted cheese curd on top of all that.
How many stars? 45.
Five.
Yeah, nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with it.
Thank you.
There's nothing wrong with it.
Simone, this is badass.
Thank you.
This is like totally
Yeah, it's badass.
Different.
Yeah, we go
it's
to
not bad, huh? It's not bad.
It's New York. Everybody's a badass here.
it comes with the marinated cabbage and a wholesome chicken broth, which we make in the house. Broth. I think it's pretty wholesome.
How long did it take you to think up this crazy idea?
How long?
Of course, if you put anything in between a jiangbing, like, you know, this crust, crunchy, delicious, it's going to be good.
It's like scallion pancake with...
But then she's got this cheese
cheese frique. Yeah. Oh.
The cheese is 100% made in New York.
Yeah. Well, and then shaved braised shank. Yeah.
That's sick.
A little bit of spice, nice bit of little Russian dressing kind of
thing. Yeah.
Kind of thing, yeah. Russian Chinese.
Everything that's sinful in one bite.
Sinful and good. Thank you. Mm. Thank you. We also have some...
told you.
Good.
No, yeah.
It's worth it.
What do you mean it's worth it?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, Simone will tell you, it was like, certainly in New York, which is probably the most hyper-competitive restaurant environment in the world, right?
Yeah.
It really helps if you have one dish, which A sort of says everything about your philosophy and magnifies everything, and something that everybody can take pictures about,
right?
That internet can digest quickly and disseminate. It's really the David Chang, the pork bun model.
Drop the name.
Right, we have to say that.
Yes.
But like that's what it is, and so you know this is like a pork bun on steroids.
It's better than any pork bun.
I'm blushing.
Yeah, whatever.
I'm very Chinese.
It's really good.
Blushing.
I'm having another bite now.
Thank
I'm gonna break my rule. The chef here, the chef's eating the whole thing, for the record.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Simone, this is so badass.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and this is just kimchi of cabbage? Or?
No, it's actually marinated, not even fermented, just cabbage.
Is that like chef speak? Like, that's how you talk to each other? This is badass.
Yeah, badass. Can I swear here? No.
Yeah, you can do whatever you want.
Fucking awesome.
Fuck yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Badass. Awesome.
And what are these dumplings?
So they are what we call hometown wontons.
Okay.
How we like to make it at home. It's like a pillow because it's easy to make. Everybody can make it, like whether you're any race, any culture, with some spiced soy and chili.
I can find you about 100 people on the street who can't make that.
Oh, I can teach them.
You
can
teach them? That's good, but yeah.
That's how I teach all my Mexican cooks how to make
again,
it.
Simone's the model for the... In many ways, the modern New York chef, trained at all the fancy restaurants. He worked with Wiley Dufresne, right? WD-50.
Yeah. Mainly just him.
And then returned to the food of her youth, but in your case, sort of the imagined food of your youth. Because you grew up in Texas, where'd you grow up?
No, I grew up
all over the place. Singapore?
Yeah, Singapore, Australia. Texas, yeah, I've been to Houston.
Yeah.
Hong Kong, Macau. So I was born in Chengdu, but didn't just only grow up there. Yeah.
But, there was this tectonic shift where the fine dining world, I mean, I like to call it the great kitchen slave revolution.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know if I've written that, but I've certainly thought it. I've written it a bunch of times. And what happened in the early, right around the millennium is that you had these chefs who were bringing the culture of the kitchen out into their dining rooms.
Right.
You had chefs who were playing the ballads, the Led Zeppelin rock ballads that they used to listen to while they were doing their mise en place and stuff. Mr. Batali was the first one to do that in a fancy restaurant.
Hey, others look at him now.
Well, it is what it is. But others did it. And you had the actual kitchen just taking... Just
over
taking over this more fusty, more mannered,
also loosening, loosening of protocol.
Yeah, well, and you had this generation which did not
adhere.
I call them the Starbucks generation. Their parents grew up, you know, eating TV dinners or gnawing on some kind of, you know, desiccated Roy Rogers roast beef sandwich in some horrific. What you know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Whereas they grew up going to Starbucks in the mall. Because we all know Starbucks is highly sophisticated. You could call it fast food. You call it whatever you want. But it requires a lot. You know, they actually beg you to have opinions and to be in your way a coffee snob. And so that generation, A, is not interested in pretense. They're used to calling their own shots. They like quality. And they don't want to go into some fancy, expensive restaurant that their parents... have told about it, listen to some guy from, you know, Alsace talking to them in a funny name.
That Starbucks reference is true. I agree with that about the culture and generation that they grew up in. But what Starbucks enabled a lot of us to do in the food world was envision something that everybody was saying that was going to conquer everything in its wake and move three steps beyond it and say, I can own a better coffee shop than Starbucks can ever be because they've got this volume idea. I know a lot more about coffee. I'm going to take the deep dive into it. And the same thing is said about food.
Sure.
There's massive expansion in chains of food, yet you come here and you're doing your own individual thing that's better than anybody can do at massive chains.
Sure.
But it's also like, how much devotion can you give to a dish? This is a very devoted dish to think up and make awesome and consistent.
Yeah.
Badass.
Thank you.
That's
where'd
badass.
Where'd you get the Frico cheese idea?
I know.
Okay, so like in Yunnan, where this cuisine is in...
Chinese don't like cheese.
Most Chinese that we think of for Chinese are the Han Chinese don't like cheese, but the ethnic Chinese like cheese.
In the South.
Yeah,
in the South.
In the border.
Or all the way around.
Border, Mongolia, Tibet. Tibetans, they like cheese. We call them Chinese cheese too because they live in China.
It's all good.
Yeah, that's another topic. So, yeah, they make mozzarella-style cheese, and they stretch it, and then they dry it in between bamboos, and then they grill it. And then they put roast jam on it. I mean, the thought of
it's
it is...
It's the like, frique halloumi of the world.
So good.
Yes.
Is it sold on the streets in the South of China?
Yeah.
Really?
Yunnan, yeah. So
this is all, in its way, an amalgam. It's a fusion Chinese...
At the same time, it's a cheesesteak.
It is the same.
Yes.
It's a badass cheese. It's better than any cheesesteak I've ever had.
Yeah.
I mean, who's had a good cheesesteak?
Nobody.
I mean, really, literally.
No, nobody.
So, anyway. So that's what I'm talking about. Now we get to eat these stuff. I mean, we're in the midst of this great ferment of delicious food everywhere, which is much more accessible.
But, I mean, we're in the midst of that, but we're at the same time, and Simone, you can probably speak to this, we're at the same time where everybody says, well, nobody can open a restaurant in Manhattan anymore. It's too expensive. You can't find people to work there.
Yeah.
So how are you working around that? I mean, this is not a big space.
It's not a big space. To us, it's still very expensive.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
I mean, I'm very new to this whole restaurant opening. This is like 3 months old, 4 months old. So I'm still struggling and learning as we grow every day and learn together. Constantly, the biggest challenge is finding cooks. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Simone also operates a 2-star restaurant.
Right.
Down in the village.
Yes.
So,
which is called?
This is a more casual.
Right, okay.
Especially there's rice noodles.
I mean, yeah.
And this is a more lunchy.
Do you do the sandwich there?
No, we just do it here.
Wow.
My sandwich is gone for the
really market. Because we only have 3 stovetop there. So right. If I
take up a
stovetop. Yeah, it's like constantly pretty exciting. Very humble, very
so and the beef shin is braised in what?
They're getting all technical now.
Wow, yeah.
They're getting all badass.
It's braised with all the mirepoix, all the aromatics, and then the Chinese spice,
Chinese five spice or
five spice, star anise, fennel, cumin, black cardamom, green cardamom, all of that with chicken broth and the previous batch of the shank.
So okay, it's ongoing. How long is the braise for and what
6 hours?
6 hours
simmering.
Okay,
yeah,
stovetop braise,
candy stove, old school, and then we take it out and we let it rest in their own braising liquid, and then we get to slice it. And then we heat it up with garlic oyster sauce and the beef shank that we blitz it and make it into another sauce.
So good.
Thank you.
So good. just don't get the temptation of suddenly opening up at, you know, one of the Brooklyn Barclays Center or something like that with a sandwich stand like that. Because the thing that... it eludes great chefs sometimes is that you, unless you're the best teacher in the world to teach people who, you know, you got to do it. You got to do it yourself.
Yeah.
Ways. And slowly but surely train people who are better and smarter than you. That's my whole shtick.
No, I agree. I agree. I try to hire people that are different from me.
Yeah.
That I told them, if you are on the line on the job, you should be better than me soon. Because I'm not on the line on the job.
Yeah.
And when I was on the line on the job at, you know, other restaurants, I work for other chefs, I should be better than the chef.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. That's awesome. Well, the food is fantastic.
Impressive.
something.
That was so good. That might be so the best. Good. Like, how can that? That was so good.
That's unquestionably
that was so five star.
I easily had in a year or two, easily.
That was so good.
Yeah, it's badass. We've already
that
talked
was
about
so
this.
Badass. All right, bye.
Thank you.
So, Adam, you've been doing
I'm taking
this.
Notes. You see,
yeah, I see.
I actually wanted
notes.
To come here because I have not. I've heard about this. I read about it on the internet. I actually wanted to taste it.
Basically, to go over what we just had. We just had a crisp scallion type pancake with no scallion in it, and then braised beef shin.
Yep.
With kind of secret sauce and yep. cucumbers, yep. and then this freaky of cheese.
All the elements of a cheese steak. Like, all of this sinfully, all of these sinful elements of a great sandwich. But it's not even a sandwich because the bread is this fried pancake, which you buy, scallion. You can put scallions in it. It's just a delicious thing in and of it by itself. And when you add all of these other things, like the crunch of,
but it's got
of
that
like the
crunch
of the cheese and the Russian dressing or whatever is the beef shanks, it's not really fair.
No, it's not
really
fair.
It's impossible. The critics like to eat one bite and then like spit it out in a spittoon or whatever.
No, if.
Mine is gone.
You ate the entirety.
It's gone.
I've got like a ring of mine left over. It is like perhaps the best sandwich I've had in years.
All right, good.
So it's a good call. Listening is one of the best attributes you can have as a human. I think it allows you to concentrate on something that's outside of your own brain and listen with empathy and understanding and learning. Makes you a better parent, better leader, better member of your community. One of the ways I listen a lot is on Audible, and Audible has the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet. And now with Audible Originals, the selection has gotten even more custom with content made for members. Listen on any device, anytime, anywhere, at home, at the gym, on the go, while you're walking, whatever. Right now, I'm listening to Jeff Tweedy's Let's Go So We Can Get Back. It's an amazing story about him as a recording artist and just life. Him as a human. And Tweedy's a very interesting human. But go to audible.com/Hugh, and you'll get a free 30-day trial. You can also text SMS code, which is Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 500-500. You should go there and listen for a change. Again, it's audible.com/Hugh or text H-U-G-H to 500-500. Audible, get on it. So 18 years ago when you started, I think that was kind of the dimming hours of Lutece and a
yep.
number of places like
yep.
that.
Lutece was still around, but it was the dimming hours.
Yes. And so what happens with the shift? What ended sort of the high end of continental food? And, but French is back in full force, which is thoroughly.
Well, French is like, you had different layers of French in New York always, right? When I started writing, Keith McNally, who's the great, he opened Odeon, which is a sort of seminal downtown brasserie, and then Balthazar. So he had established the mid-range brasserie fashion. So that was going great guns. But at the same time, you had the famous the Le and the La restaurants, the old French restaurants, which were really Le Grouille, Caravelle. Which were all the product of their own revolution. That really, when the French was a famous, it was really the pavilion, which was named after the French pavilion, which was in the World Expo, which is in whatever it was 50, and all the chefs came out of there and started their own restaurants, and that it ran its course. You know, it was like anything, it was a good run. They were getting older. More importantly, their clientele is getting older, and I actually reviewed the Le Caravelle, which was famously Jackie Kennedy's favorite restaurant. It was owned by they're still living in the city, very civilized French couple. And then it just closed. Gave it a good review, didn't matter. Everybody gave it good reviews. It just closed. They couldn't, the economics were just against them. So you had that. So you had the sort of the passage of time. Then you had the brasseries, which is like the casual, the kind of food that people really I mean, New York is a pretty conservative town, mm-hmm. dining-wise. You don't see a lot of crazy experimentation. New Yorkers like food that's reliable and fast. And it's a, you know, there's a reason the porterhouse steak.
Thing. I didn't really thought about
it. Oh, yeah,
that.
No. Well, it's not. I mean, you can come here and do crazy things.
Chicago and L.A. have more.
Much more experimental. Yeah. Because, you can indulge yourself more. You don't have these pressures. And New Yorkers tend to be mean about that stuff. The experiments are really on the margins. Anyway, you had those old French way, the old French sort of style dying, the clientele dying, and for a while, the actual techniques went away, and you had this resurgence of what I was talking about of the culture of the kitchen, and over time, the culture of the kitchen, as any revolution. It synthesizes what it's overthrown and comes up with another.
It again.
It's a Marxist
it's a
theory.
Cycle of
it's yes, a Marxist it, no, it's a Marxist theory.
It's these, pretty tried and produces. True.
And so, I don't know if people are opening fancy French restaurants, but that quote unquote revolutionary, Tom Colicchio in his way was actually not in his way. I mean, his restaurant Kraft, which you may have done. I mean, Kraft was a classically. I mean, what Tom did at Kraft, and I've written that Kraft is the Pavillon of its day, is that he took all of these strands, foraging, again, all the things that chefs hold dear or are supposed to hold dear, the sanctity of your ingredients, the technique of the braise, the simple techniques. I mean, initially he had no recipes in that restaurant, no sauces. He just wanted you. It was a very
stark. He wanted you to pick the way it would be cooked and then the sauce and then the accompaniment.
But he wanted you to appreciate the craft, appreciate the things of the chef.
Right.
Right.
But it was way too complicated.
No, it didn't work.
It didn't work. It was like the most complex meat.
It wasn't functional. Yeah. So, but it became functional. And what he did is he succeeded in that restaurant is taking, raising all of these quite simple ideas, the perfect mushroom. The perfect chicken, the perfect farm. I called it oat barnyard, that style, but raise them to the level of a kind of a snobism and fashion that New Yorkers specialize in and can understand.
So, did the advent of a craft was that the invitation for us all to pay $16 for a roasted carrot salad?
Yeah, it was.
But also, again.
And a lot of fancy chefs, very influential chefs, pass through Tom's kitchens. I would actually argue that he opened a little restaurant, I don't know if you remember, next to Kraft called Kraft Bar.
Yes.
And Kraft Bar was really the model for more restaurants these days than you can count. Right.
It was, yeah.
Delicious little meatballs that his mama used to make.
Great wine program.
Perfect breadsticks, all casual, but extremely high quality,
mm-hmm.
right? Pork belly, all the stuff that chefs loved, all the stuff that their mama and papa used to make back in the neighborhood, but done in a very simple way. And it was a bar called Kraft Bar. So they had a big, long bar where you could eat. Counter dining was something that Tom learned from obviously working for Danny Meyer and also just being a New Yorker. And that restaurant where David Chang famously worked for a nanosecond, became a template for a lot of young chefs who did go downtown or out into the boroughs. It was a very economical model, and it was a model that appealed to a lot of people.
Right.
And I think, that was really the stealth pavillon of its day. And
yeah.
Kraft is still survived. Kraft is still there, and Kraft is like, but you do pay 18, 19, 25 bucks for your carrots. But but that's New York.
But they're
right?
good carrots.
It's a great, it's a damn good
that's,
carrot.
That's everywhere
it's
in the
a damn
world
good,
now.
It's a damn good
the
carrot.
The carrots have names. So,
it's
yeah,
a damn good
it's,
carrot.
It's a different
and like, in this world,
world
like, I don't know, the whole farm to table has been around. It's been parodied a lot. It's, God, you're probably tired of it.
Yeah, it jumped the shark.
And it's jumped the shark. It's been replaced by other stuff. Southern, there are other styles. There are other...
Yeah.
The
problem with farm to table for me is it's been so co-opted, as plenty of us do it with full-on zeal, that it's become so co-optable that it doesn't matter anymore.
Everybody does it. Well,
yeah.
I mean, if you know the French the chefs in Yunnan were doing it 500 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. But it's never...
Again, New Yorkers love to put these labels on things. I mean, New York is... you know, New Yorkers specialize, it's not just food, in all of these creative disciplines in making them fashionable. Now, I think the internet has changed that. I think chefs, as you know, chefs don't have to. It used to be, even in, when I started writing, that chefs thought they had to come here to make their reputations, right? You probably did when you were growing up. Where, I mean, that, they thought they did, right?
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, for about a year or so, they did.
And then they went back home, and that changed.
And then
everything.
They went back home, or then they, you know,
but they used to
open their
home.
Downtown thing, or, yeah. or Mr. Chang opened his downtown thing randomly just to try and make some, you know, or you had the, you know, the model changed, and with that, with the craft bar era, you'd have to do that, and with the internet, you'd have to do that. Like if the food people, if you, first of all, if you're a chef, why come to New York, right? It's such a hassle.
It's such a hell.
And this in this day and age, you can open your place in Austin, Texas, or in Athens,
Georgia.
Oh, it's
totally changed. You can open up, and I've had some of the best meals in the last 5 years in places like Minneapolis.
Right, and right, New York still has, I think, more density.
Yeah,
and it's got more variety. And it's got a culture of restaurants, which is something that's very hard to duplicate. Right. I mean, I'll go to Austin, for instance, and I'll eat at the Five. Austin's got a lot of, I don't know if I should have picked Austin, because there is an old culture of a certain style of food there, Tex-Mex and barbecue. But, you know, the restaurants like, say, this, where we are, you know, there are six of those in Austin, or there are five, you know, you go to Birmingham.
Almost 2 million people now.
Right. But anyway,
I do think that that type of thing exists in a couple of cities still. L.A. is definitely, it exists.
Sure.
San Francisco, it doesn't, because it's been priced out of the market generally.
Right.
It does exist in Montreal very strongly.
Yeah. With a, again, an old culture. Sort of
yeah,
French
old
style.
Culture backbone.
The thing about it is, in New York, is New Yorkers go out to eat all the time. Right? Because there's no space. They don't want to cook in their kitchens. They like to talk about food. They have disposable income. And there is this, you know, if you come to New York, one of the first things, the culture of dining is one of the real things that defines the city, you know, like the subway.
Do you ever cook at home?
Randomly. I'm like a random. I like cook stews.
Stews.
Like I have two daughters and a skinny wife who's getting skinnier and skinnier. Because she now refuses to go to any restaurants. She's like, I'm done with this. Actually, she was done with it like after about a year. It's like, okay, have fun.
But now the kids.
They sort of go, and I use them as props. My oldest daughter is somewhat of a sophisticated food person. Actually, her palate's much more sophisticated than mine, which is not saying much. But my younger daughter tends to be, she's like, you know, she likes the basics, like ramen and pancakes and, you know, things like that.
Well, there's nothing wrong with those. She would like this. It's a pancake sandwich.
She wouldn't. What she would do with this is she would like probably take the little parts of it out and like sort of dissect it like a raccoon does a fish.
Oh, that takes a skill set.
Yes, it does.
As Simone, the chef and owner, has delivered a Satsuma tangerines to the table.
Perfect.
Just started their season.
Perfect.
And they're beautiful. But I think that is a good invitation for me to wish Adam Platt a good evening. He's off to dine for something.
Yeah, I think I like a 7-course kaiseki meal that I have to ingest now.
Well, that's good. You know, kaiseki's what? Small.
It ain't be as good as this.
Is it the one where they start the timer?
I don't know.
Are you excited?
It's all a blur, my friend.
Is this your excitement?
I was excited.
You ramped it up.
No. This was my call. Like, let's come. I want to try this sandwich. And so, yeah, I'm excited, and I give it 5 stars.
It is one fantastic sandwich. So if you come to Midtown, come up to 53rd and
3rd Street, yeah,
and Little Tong Noodle Shop, and Simone will make you probably what I think is the best sandwich I've pretty much ever had.
That's you know, everyone's a critic, but that's saying something. And you know what? I'd agree with you.
I'd say badass.
It's badass.
Badass.
All right.
Thank you, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
This episode of Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot was taped on location at Little Tong Noodle Shop, you should go, in Midtown Manhattan. Thanks to Simone Tong, the chef there and the owner, and a wonderful human, for letting us tape there and for making us a fantastic lunch. Scott Porch produces the show for Himalaya Media with field recording by Brian Blum, sound design by Alex Ramsey, and editing by Mackenzie Mazzell. You can follow Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like what you hear, rate, review, tell a friend, retweet it, shout it out from a window, whatever. And come back Tuesdays for a new episode. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Hugh Atchison. Thanks for listening. Eat well. Be swell.